Florida Telehealth Foundation is proud to introduce you to Do Good Volunteer of the Month, Patrick Dietrich from Superior Search and Rescue. Patrick volunteers his time to train outside the area and bring it back to the team. The new training programs have been a huge help. During several missing person searches, his knowledge on building search tactics helped make searches successful. If you know an incredible volunteer like Patrick, go to dogoodcc.org and nominate them to be recognized as the next Do Good in the Copper Country Volunteer of the Month.
Welcome back to segment two of Copper Country Today. I'm Todd Van Dyke. We're brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. Learn more about them at phfgive.org. As we broadcast this on Sunday morning, it is really hard for me to believe that next weekend is Memorial Day weekend. Memorial Day is a week from tomorrow, and at least unofficially, our summer season starts here in the Copper Country and elsewhere as well. And as we start to get out and stretch our legs and enjoy the outdoors, there are things that we need to watch out for and things we need to be cautious of and prepared for, and hopefully most of them won't kill us, but hey, forewarned is forearmed. So I've asked Tanya Rule from the Western UP Health Department, she's the Environmental Health Director, to come in, and we're going to talk a little bit about things that could hurt us this summer and how to avoid that. We don't want to be injured. We don't want to be sick. And so, Tanya, thank you, and welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you inviting us in to talk again.
Let's start with Memorial Day weekend coming up. People are going to be breaking out the barbecues. They're going to have people over. Excuse me. We're going to have all sorts of parties going on and such. Let's start with food safety, because this can be a problem. It's fairly easy to get sick if you don't obey the basic rules.
That is true. I would say that the average 1 in 6 people will have some sort of illness on an annual basis from consuming food that was not handled properly and did cause them to have an illness.
Yeah, and we talk about this being outdoors and such, but some of these rules apply on a pretty much daily basis for what's going on in your kitchen, obviously.
Yes, food handling is really the most important aspect of food safety. So you want to always make sure you're washing your hands with warm water and soap prior to any food handling. And going into the summer season, we're eating a lot more produce, fresh fruits and vegetables, and you want to make sure you're always washing those thoroughly under running water to wash any pathogens off the produce before you do consume it.
But now let's say I'm going out to a picnic spot in the park or in the wilderness or someplace like that, out at camp where maybe I don't have running water and access to a lot of these things. I don't have warm water. I don't have soap. Can I use the spritzy disinfectant stuff too?
You could, if it's on more of a private personal level, you know, hand sanitizer or hand sanitizer wipes would be appropriate for like a picnic. I mean, obviously that's not something you could use in a restaurant situation.
Right. Right. And that's, you know, commercial food preparation is a whole different thing. And we're not really addressing that with this program, but we want to make sure that folks who are going out perhaps next weekend and going to spend maybe their first weekend at camp or out to one of our state parks or our local parks and put together something, grill up some brats or some burgers or things of that nature, that things stay safe. Refrigeration, very important when food is outdoors.
Yes, anytime you're going to have food, if you're going to be out of the refrigerator, especially for over a 4-hour period, it's really important to monitor the temperature of that food. We recommend making sure your food is packed on ice, check it with a thermometer, and you want to make sure the temperature is below 41 degrees Fahrenheit.
And obviously a good cooler with ice in it, that'll keep it for a certain period of time. But if you're going camping, say, for the weekend, you've got to be a little careful if you set up Friday night and Monday morning comes along.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to depend on the quality of the cooler and the type of ice packs that you do use. There's definitely better quality coolers and ice packs that will, you know, last several days. They're rated to maintain temperature below 41 for several days.
Yeah, the difference between the ice packs, the gelled things, and the actual ice, is one better than the other?
Well, ice and water being in contact with the food container will actually keep the food colder than just ice packs. So sometimes we'll recommend using a combination of both.
Okay. And ice needs to be checked if you're out for a period of time. And there are lots of people that sell it, so not a terribly expensive thing to do. So we are going to keep our cold things cold. Our hot things. Let's say I'm bringing out some bratwursts, and they're not pre-cooked. and I'm going to be putting, or I'm bringing out some sausages or something like that, pork products especially. Obviously, they have to be heated to a certain temperature to be safe.
Yes, sometimes people do consume foods where they grill it, not necessarily to the proper temperature, and then they get sick from the bacteria that's associated with that raw food product. So we always recommend, you know, even in your home situation where you're out camping, have a thermometer, check the temperature of the food. You want to make sure when you're cooking burgers, you're bringing them to at least an internal temperature of 155 degrees. If it's more like those bratwursts you're talking about or chicken products, you want to bring those to at least 165 degrees internal temperature. And really the only way to know that you're reaching that temperature is to use a thermometer.
Is there an appropriate way to make sure that the temperature that you're getting is correct and you just haven't hit a lucky hot spot?
Yeah, you want to always check the temperature in the centermost portion of the food so that you're getting the internal temperature, which where it would cook the last.
If it's chicken, do you want to be near the bone or away from the bone? Does it matter?
Just the center part of the breast, especially okay. If it's like a whole bird, you know, the inside of the cavity might be to temperature, but the internal part of that thickest part of the meat flesh might not be to temperature. Yeah, so you want to check it in several spots.
Yeah, don't cheat and just use the thin pieces.
And make sure you're hitting that 165 for the chicken.
Sure, that's 165. And then the red stuff comes pouring out of it. Because if you see red coming out of chicken or pork or things like that to some of that water that's still tinted kind of pinkish, that's a warning sign.
I mean, it is a warning sign, but I don't want people to rely just on the coloring.
Right. It's not something you can rely on. But if you've already checked and it's still happening, you maybe need to double check.
Cook it a little bit longer, yes.
So we're going to be careful outside doing our cooking. We're going to make sure that the cold stuff stays cold, the hot stuff stays hot. If you are handling the raw meats and chickens, that's when you do need to wash your hands again.
Yes, definitely. And if you're out camping and you have a situation where you can't wash your hands, recommend packing along some disposable gloves so that you could use the gloves for handling the raw meats, especially if you don't have the ability to wash your hands after.
Oh, that's a good idea, because those plastic gloves are very inexpensive at the store, and you can put them in with your trash, and you can carry them back out with you, because we always take our trash back home, unless you're at a place that has a storage place. You don't leave it sitting around wherever you are. That's not good either. Let's talk about let me ask you this, Tanya. When do I need to talk to the health department about getting some kind of permit for what I'm serving? Obviously, if it's just me and my family, I'm fine. What if I'm, for example, doing the church, where our church is going to have an outdoor service, we're going to grill up some hot dogs and hamburgers afterwards, and visitors are invited. Have I crossed the line at that point, or where do we think that line is?
We're definitely moving into the season of summer festivals, fairs, public events where there's food offered to the public. Anytime you're preparing and serving food to the public, irregardless if you're charging or not, you do need a license to serve food to the public. So during the summer months, we do issue a lot of temporary food licenses. They are good for one location. It can be for a one-day event, or they can be valid for up to 14 consecutive days in one location. It's really easy to apply. You can apply on go through our website, or you could stop at any of our offices. Two-page application. Really, it's the contact information, the menu, some food handling questions, and then one of our inspectors will come to the location the day of the event. Do a pre-inspection and then issue the license.
What type of things would I typically have to put together? Do I have to have a sink with running water for this? Do I have to have refrigerated storage? What do I need?
Well, if it's just a temporary event, so think about like at the 4th of July, a lot of organizations are maybe cooking hot dogs and brats and hamburgers to sell to the public. They can just set up a temporary stand where you could have coolers with ice. You can have 3 bins to wash, rinse, and sanitize the dishes with potable water that's hauled in, you know, clean containers. Hand washing station. We do have information on how to set up a temporary hand washing station. But that's really more for like a limited food event. If you're going to be having more complex food preparation, where you're going to be handling and processing a lot of potentially hazardous food, then you'd be better served to have it in like a kitchen where you can have running water and things like that.
And in some cases, you can prepare things in a kitchen and then transfer them
yes.
to your sale location. So that kind of covers you if you really get to that level.
Yep. And that happens a lot where we, might license the preparation site and then allow just off-site service and catering.
We've seen more and more food trucks, vendors, kind of coming up into the area. I know that's a big fad in a lot of major cities. We're seeing a few more of them here. They, I assume, also have to be licensed by the health department.
They do. We have quite a few more food trucks than in the past. And like you said, they're quite popular. They hold a license that the health department does issue. It's a Department of Agriculture transitory food truck license. So once they obtain that license, they can go anywhere in the state of Michigan, and they just need to obtain 2 inspections per year, and they file a notice of intent with whatever health department they're going to be serving in, and then they let us know if they need an inspection or not. And it's a definitely a up-and-coming business that we see.
It is, and frankly, I quite like it because I go out to places, there's more choices of things to eat, and it's reassuring to know that they are meeting standards.
They have to meet the same standards as a regular restaurant.
Yeah, it's reassuring to know that they're meeting standards, so I don't have to worry about what I'm getting from them. You mentioned, Tanya Roll, you mentioned water, potable water. That's something that comes up every once in a while here in the Copper Country. I'm out hiking. My canteen is empty. That stream looks pretty darn clear. I should be able to drink from that, don't you think?
Well, surface water does contain bacteria and parasites like Giardia and Cryptosporidium that, even though the water looks clean, they can be cause you to get some severe gastrointestinal illnesses if you do consume that water. So if you are hiking or backpacking, most people, if you're not hauling bottled water, you would probably have a filtration system where you can filter the water to take out those parasites.
Do those filtration systems work? I mean, I've seen them over the years, and I've wondered, okay, is this really legitimate? Is this going to take out what needs to be taken out?
There's definitely hiking filtration systems that are rated to remove bacteria and like parasites from surface water. You see that a lot like up in Isle Royale. Backpackers and hikers will filter their water, and they are rated to work.
Yeah, they're rated to work. That's what we'll say. In Isle Royale, obviously, it's kind of a whole different area. If you're going to Isle Royale and you're going to be out backpacking for a period of time, you're not going to find running water. You're not going to find a lot of the safety things that we still have if we go to a local park here. So.
And you do have to be concerned with those filtration units because the one thing they're not rated to remove is the toxins from like harmful algal blooms. So anytime you are filtering water when you're hiking or backpacking, you want to make sure that the water is visibly clear, and that if you're seeing any indication of harmful algal blooms, the water is discolored, you would not want to filter that water because those filtration units do not filter out the toxins that are associated with harmful algae.
We have seen a few of these algal blooms in the Copper Country over the last several years. Of course, a lot of ponds, a lot of places get algae. It's not necessarily a harmful thing. There are some algaes that, if you do them right, can be quite beneficial and good for us. Not that we want to take that raw, but some of the blooms, it was several years ago, I think, your office had to issue a warning about a harmful algal bloom in the area. If I'm swimming, if I'm hiking and I see water, what should I look for? And is there a way that I can tell that algal bloom is harmful or just benign?
I mean, visibly, anytime you're recreating or, swimming, contacting the water, you want to make sure the water is just always clear. That's like the best message you can give the public, is not to contact water if it's not clear. But if you're looking at different types of algae that's in the water, if it looks more like green spilled paint, I guess I would describe it as, in the water, that's typically more of a harmful, it has the potential to be a harmful algal bloom. There's no way to know if there's toxins being produced or not without actually testing the water. And if you're seeing algae that's more like fibrous and you can pick it up, that type does not typically produce toxins in the water. We do test surface water for toxins associated with harmful algal blooms. So if the public is out recreating and swimming and they see algal blooms, they can report that. And then we will go out and collect a sample and test to determine if there is toxins present.
Is there an odor that gives anything away or not?
No, not generally. It's more just like a visible indication.
Okay, so visible. So if the water's not clear, do not go near.
That's great advice.
Look there. We've coined something. We can copyright and trademark and sell that on T-shirts and we'll be rich.
Yeah, we do participate in that toxin testing program. And we give half of our supplies each year to the National Park Service so that they can test the inland lakes on Isle Royale, because they've had a lot of algal blooms in the inland lakes up there as of recently, and they just want to make sure that their visitors to the park, when they're filtering water, that they're filtering safe water.
Yeah, absolutely. Tanya Rule is the Environmental Health Director for the Western UP Health Department. It was a few years ago, I think, that you began testing more aggressively water at swimming beaches across the Copper Country. And every once in a while in the summer, we'll get a note from you folks saying, avoid this beach for a couple of days, avoid that beach for a couple of days. Why did you increase that testing a few years ago? What are you looking for?
We actually began our beach monitoring program in 2004. So we're coming up on our 20-year anniversary of sampling beaches. But over the years, we have definitely expanded the number of beaches that we test for. We originally started, I think, testing around 10 beaches. Last year, we were up to 20. And now this year, for this coming 2023 swimming season, throughout our five counties, we're going to sample 30 beaches, 14 of those located in Houghton and Keweenaw counties.
Which ones? Do you have the list? I should have looked it up.
Yeah, I don't have the list with me. We will post it on our website. But most of the popular swimming sites, so Houghton Beach, Hancock, we do McLean State Park, we do Prince's Point at MTU, Chassel, Calumet Waterworks, we're going to do Bay Degree, we do the Sandy Bottom Beach in Dollar Bay.
I know the KBIC does some of these as well down in Baraga County, Second Sand Beach. Do they do the head of the bay down
they
there
do.
Too?
I believe yes. They do. Yes, KBIC samples 7 locations in Baraga County, and then we do the Launce Waterfront Park. We do the Second Sands Beach.
Oh, you do Second Sand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a lot of these beaches are being tested. What are you looking for, and what causes you to shut a beach down?
Okay, so we sample each day once per week throughout a 10-week swimming season. So we collect samples, 3 samples at each beach, and then we take the geometric mean, and we're testing for E. coli. So the EPA sets a standard for recreational water of 300 through 100 milliliters of water of E. coli. And E. coli causes gastrointestinal type illnesses, you know, diarrhea, vomiting. And so once the level's over 300, we would deem that beach closed for swimming.
I don't know how I survived to adulthood, because I grew up on a lake and I spent most of the summer in it. And when I would get thirsty, I would just drink a little bit of the lake water. And my parents would say, don't be drinking the lake water. And I did. And somehow I survived. But it's not a good idea, is it?
It's not. You don't want to consume surface water. There's E. coli. Like I mentioned earlier, there could be Giardia and Cryptosporidium and things like that that can cause you to get pretty sick.
The E. coli, we tend to associate that rather distastefully with feces.
Mm-hmm.
Who's pooping in the lake?
Well, I would say in general, our beaches, especially here in the Western UP and along Lake Superior, are generally quite safe. If you take the total number of samples we do per year, the number of beach closures or advisories is relatively low.
Well, I've seen some reports from downstate, and there are beaches that are closed routinely, you know, almost week in and week out through the summer, because there are so many people using them. There's so much runoff that they have problems all the time. We're very fortunate.
We are. And we actually removed some beaches off of our inventory this year because they're just so clean every year that there's almost no detection. So it's just not necessary to keep putting our resources towards testing those. So each year we do change the list based on sample results from past years. We tend to see those beach closures following rain events where we have, you know, extreme you know, a high volume rain intensity, you know, a half inch or more of rain, and you're getting a lot of runoff water from that rain event. So you're washing basically the ground surface, animal feces, you know, or you could have sanitary sewer discharges during large rain events that wash into the water and cause it to be, you know, elevated with bacteria.
Yeah, this is not really usually a result of either a whole bunch of animals or a whole bunch of people using the beach as a bathroom. This is mostly from runoff that started, originated up on dry land and gets run in. And we've certainly noticed over the years that as we have rain events, then we have problems, and every once in a while a beach has to be closed. How long does it typically take to clear?
It can take a day or two after that rain event. Again, depending on the beach. If there is a river discharge at the beach, it can take longer to clear up. So usually following a large rain event, the rivers that discharge to the beach will be flowing, where they might not necessarily flow, you know, during the summer months, or the flow is much slower. And then after the rain event, you get a lot of discharge to the beach, the water will be discolored, and the water will be warmer, which tends to attract the kids to want to swim in the warmer water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the good place to swim.
So we always recommend after a rain event to avoid swimming in the river discharges, because those are usually where you have the high E. coli.
Swimmer's itch, do we get that?
Some of our inland lakes do have swimmer's itch, where you have warmer water, stagnant water. If you have to have ducks living in that environment, so you definitely, we do see some swimmer's itch.
How do you deal with that?
Really, we just post an advisory to not swim in that area if there's a documented case there. Our recommendation always for preventing swimmer's itch is to towel dry when you leave the water.
Briskly.
Yep.
Briskly. Don't just pat yourself down. I have some experience with this in my life. You towel dry very, very briskly when you leave the water, and that will reduce or eliminate. So, and as we wrap this thing up here, Tanya, let's talk about those icky little bugs, those ticks. I'm already hearing that people are encountering ticks, and some of them can be very, very dangerous.
They can be. There's 20 different tick species in the state of Michigan, Houghton, Keweenaw counties. We are a confirmed area for the black-legged ticks that cause Lyme disease.
Yes.
People will call the black-legged ticks deer ticks. So they are known to be in this area, and they do cause Lyme disease.
Now, how do I recognize that tick as opposed to one of the other more benign ticks?
Well, the deer ticks are much smaller than the standard, like, dog tick. So they're smaller, they're darker in color. I would say I'd recommend everyone, you know, go on the internet. You could go on the Western UP Health Department website. We have some visual aids that can help you, you know, take a look to determine what type of tick it is. We also do distribute tick identification ticks. If you have a tick on you, or if it's bitten you and you want us to identify that, you can bring the tick into our office. We can take a look at it for you, give you an opinion on the species, and we can also send it in to, like, 100% determine what that species is.
Best way to remove a tick if it's bitten in?
Well, just take your tweezers and, you know, get the tweezer as close to your skin and just, you know, pull slowly.
Because you don't want to leave any remnant of that tick under the skin.
Correct. You know, you can get an infection that way. But really the best prevention is just doing a thorough inspection of your body or your pets when you come in from outdoors and look for any ticks. And usually you can remove them, you know, when they're still walking on you or they've maybe just bitten in.
Yeah. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If you're going out into the long grass or out into the woods, long pants, tuck the pants into your socks if you can so that you don't give the tick a way to get in.
Correct. We also do recommend, like, especially if you can spend considerable amount of time outdoors, in the long grass and brush, you can pre-treat your boots, pants, and gear with permethrin. It's a type of pesticide that you do not want to put on your skin, but you can spray, like, your boots, your jacket, your jeans, let it dry, and then that's really effective in prevention of the ticks from you know, staying on you, because you tend to be walking through the long grass. They're hanging out on the tops of the blades, and then as you walk by, they latch onto you, and they then tend to climb and bite, you know, into the skin. But if you pre-treat your gear with the permethrin, they'll just fall off.
They won't like that.
So. But you definitely do not want to put the permethrin directly on your skin.
All right, 10-year-old, we've got to wrap this up here, but thank you for the good advice. We hope that everybody has a safe and happy summer and no problems with any of the things that we've talked about. If you do have any questions, get in touch with the health department. They'll be happy to answer your questions for you. Thank you, Tanya.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.